It's October 15th, 2025, at Bayagiri Monastery. We did the funeral chanting this evening for our dear friend Nit, who was part of the monastery life for a very long time. Served the winter retreat in 2020, or early 2021, I believe, somewhere around there. And she was just around a lot, and the monastery was a big part of her life, and so it was a bit unexpected that she passed away suddenly. And after she had served the winter retreat, those 4 or 5 years ago, she did suffer from a massive stroke and was disabled after that, but just had always had such a good attitude. And it's kind of like the healing power of laughter. She was always kind of laughing and giggling and laughing at her situation and getting others to laugh about it as well. And before that, she was actually a very skilled massage therapist, so she lost those abilities, but she was totally okay with that. She was able to let go of it. And whenever somebody passes away, I found I end up trying to recollect my last interactions with them, the last time I saw them, the last conversation I had with them. And I'm pretty sure that the last conversation I had with Yom Nit was, she was telling me, "Ajahn, I'm not afraid of death. I'm not afraid to die. Just want to let you know, I'm not afraid to die." She's kind of laughing about it. And I thought that's quite profound, actually. And what makes somebody not afraid to die? And it's not just anybody who's not afraid to die who really isn't afraid to die. And in the Buddhist teachings, it comes from virtue, body, speech, and mind. When somebody lives a virtuous life and lives a very upstanding life and is devoted to doing good deeds, then the natural result of that is they're not afraid of death. And so one who really isn't afraid to die is one who has been devoted to good deeds, one who's led an upright life of honesty and integrity and devoted to precepts. So it's no wonder Yom Nit was able to say that, because she did lead a very good life. And even though it was cut short, I think she was 65 or something, but it's the same time as, and it was actually, when you think about it, a very good death. She laid down in her garden and didn't get up. And of course, they took her to the hospital, put her on life support. But it seems that since that moment when she laid down in the garden and didn't get up, and she wasn't conscious since then. So I believe it was fairly pain-free, and she was surrounded by family and loved ones and friends stopping by to speak to her and just wish her well. So I think it probably happened in almost the best way possible. There's a story in the Jataka tales of past life of the Buddha when the Buddha was named Prince Chandra. So very, very long time ago, off in some other world age, some other lifetime. And this is when one of the lives where the Bodhisatta was cultivating the parami of Satcha, or truthfulness, Satcha parami. And at that time, there was a horrific bandit in the region named Sada Prarudita, and he was known for eating humans. So he would capture people and eat them. And he was feared across the countryside. And he especially loved young princes. That was his favorite. So he wanted to, his dream was to capture this Prince Chandra, who was the most famed and supposedly virtuous prince in the region. So as the story goes, Prince Chandra is out with his retinue, and they're going at some sort of outing in the countryside, and there's a big ruckus in the distance, and his generals say, Prince, the Sada Prarudita is coming. We have to retreat. We have to get back. We have to run to safety. And then he says, no, I want to see what he wants. Let's see what he wants. And so everybody else is scared and running away, and the prince is not afraid. And so he steps forward, and this huge ogre of a person says, "It's you I want," and runs up and grabs the prince, throws him over his shoulder, takes him to his lair. And he gets to his lair and sets the prince down on a pile of bones of former princes that he ate. And then is kind of looking at him, watching him, and says, "Why aren't you afraid? Everybody else I captured was afraid. What's wrong with you? Why aren't you afraid?" And he says, "Well, you know, I can't remember any intentional bad action that I've done that I regret in this lifetime. That's why I'm not afraid." And he says, okay. But then it turns out earlier that day, on part of his outing, this Prince Chandra had gone to see a wise Brahmin, and the wise Brahmin had offered him 4 verses of Dhamma. And then upon recollecting, now that he's been captured, upon recollecting this, he thinks, "I forgot to give that wise Brahmin a donation." And because of that thought, he starts to cry. And then this ogre says, "Why are you crying? Is it because you're afraid to die?" He says, "No, I'm crying because I forgot to give that wise Brahmin a donation that taught me some Dhamma earlier today. If you allow me to go and give him a donation, I promise I'll come back." And he says, "How could that be? How could I let you go do that? And how could you possibly come back? You must be lying." And he says, "I have never told a lie in my life, and I will never tell a lie. And I promise if you let me go, I will come back." And so he says, "Okay, well, that's almost unbelievable, but I'm willing to test you." And so he said, he allows him to go. And once the Prince Chandra goes and he wants to go back, he goes back to the palace to get some of his money to give this wise Brahmin a donation. And of course, everybody's like, "How could you go back? You have to stay. You have to stay. This is crazy." He says, "No, I made a promise. I have to go back. I promised him I would go back." So he goes back to the wise Brahmin, offers this wise Brahmin 1,000 gold pieces for every one of the 4 verses he offered him. And then he goes back to the ogre's lair. And this ogre has the fire going to cook him when he comes back. So he comes back and the ogre is in disbelief that he's come back. And he said he can't believe it. And he comes back and the prince sits down and says, "Okay, I'm back. Now you can eat me." And the ogre says, "I'll know the right time to eat you. The fire is smoking right now. It'll ruin the taste of your flesh. In the meantime, tell me what this Brahmin taught you that was so important that you would leave just to give him a donation." And then the prince says, "Well, I could teach it to you, but people like you could never understand the Dhamma because you are a killer of people and have an unwholesome mind state. And there's no way you could understand it because if you're stuck in your evil ways." And this outrages the ogre. "What do you mean? You kings and princes kill deer with your arrows." And then he says, "Yes, some kings and princes do that sometimes, and that is wrong. But you kill and eat people, which is far more heinous and far more bad karma. And there's no way you could understand the Dhamma." And then at this point, this ogre, Satapaurudita, starts to have a change of heart. And he starts weeping. And he bows at the prince's feet and says, "Please, I will repent of my evil ways if you just tell me a little bit of Dhamma." And then he says, "Okay." He seems to be a vessel for the Dhamma now. So, and then this ogre recites a verse. He says, "Having seen my own wrongdoings in the mirror of the Dhamma, I am tormented. And now, please teach me the Dhamma." So it's this request for Dhamma teaching. And that is a very powerful story, I think. It's a very powerful story about someone who doesn't fear death, and also the power of truthfulness, the power of Satchaparami, how that can truly change the heart of someone who is evil to someone who is good. And then at the end of the story, he vows to become a Dhamma protector this ogre becomes a Dhamma protector. He gives up killing and he becomes a protector of people, especially Dhamma practitioners. So sometimes stories like that can be very, very helpful for us in that it points to the power of making a promise, the power of truthfulness, the power of integrity. And these are all part and parcel of the Buddha's teachings. And we might, when we think about Buddhism, we might think about meditation or mindfulness. And yes, those are a big part of it, but also truthfulness, honesty, and integrity. That is also just as much, if not more so, a big part of what our practice is and what we're supposed to be cultivating here. And when we do cultivate those things, then there is almost a strong sense of honor or a sense of almost a heroic aspect, a courageous aspect to the practice. Because I think all of us want to help the world. We want the world to be a better place. We want bad people to become good people. We want people to stop doing unwholesome actions in the world. And I would think all of us want that. But how does that come about? It's not so easy to make that come about. Usually when we get angry, what are we angry at? We're angry at other people's anger. And usually when we get upset, we're upset because other people are upset. But what is that doing but adding to the more of that same energy? So really, how do we flip things around? We flip things around with really strong honesty, really strong integrity. And it's good to question ourselves. As practitioners, it behooves us to question ourselves, how often are we coming from those biases and unquestioned assumptions, unquestioned worldviews? When we act from an unquestioned assumption, then the fruits aren't going to be that efficacious of whatever actions we're engaging in. When we act from a basis of unquestioned assumptions. So how do we actually affect a change? We do need to cultivate these things for ourselves so that in the story, the prince, he's already cultivated this sense of truthfulness and virtue his whole life. And this was a story that illustrates the culmination of that or the power of that. So we do need to cultivate these things. We need to build it up. We can't just apply the practice in the moment if we haven't built it up already. And we can't just grab a knife and use it when we need to cut something. We have to have sharpened that knife well beforehand. And just having a knife doesn't mean we're going to be able to cut things. Now, the knife might be dull. So we need to learn how to sharpen knives. And sharpening knives is perhaps also a good analogy for practice in that it takes skill. And it's not just about, you know, taking a knife to the mechanical grinder and putting it through there. That gets one level of sharpness, but it's still fairly coarse. So we can be content with that level of sharpness, or we can strive for the samurai sword level of sharpness, which is what's going to cut through defilement. So to do that, though, takes training, takes work. You know, sharpening a knife in a electronic knife sharpener doesn't really take much training, doesn't really take much effort, doesn't really take much skill. But to sharpen a knife on a whetstone and then to work up through the finer and finer stones until you have something that's razor sharp, that takes real skill. And the reason it takes skill is because it's not just about how many times you run the blade over that whetstone. It's about getting the angle just right. And then even if you get the angle just right, then it's about knowing the right number of strokes on the stone, because if you do it too much, you get what's called overhone, and then it's not sharp anymore. And then if you want to undo the overhone, then you have to actually use a slurry as one method. You use another stone and rub it against the first stone and create a slurry. And then those microscopic grains can rub off the overhone on the knife, and then it can become really razor sharp. And then if you want it to become even sharper, you have to strop it on a piece of leather. And you strop the knife and you get off all the microscopic metal filaments on the edge of the knife. And then you have something that's very, very sharp. And something that's very sharp is actually safer to use. It'll cut everything. It'll cut whatever we like. And the way you test this is you hover over your skin. You don't touch the knife to the skin, but you hover over your skin. And then you see if the hairs on your arm get cut when you're hovering the knife over your skin. And then you know it's razor sharp. And then there's different levels of sharpness there as well. There's the hairs that they kind of like, when you run the knife through the arm hairs and they pop apart, those are called loud poppers. So when the hairs pop apart, the loud poppers, but then you can get it even sharper than that. When you get it sharper than that, then the hairs pop quietly. Those are called quiet poppers. And then when you don't realize it's cutting the hairs and they just sort of fall in half, that's called the silent slicer. So that's the ultimate level of sharpness. So you could make this an analogy for the coarser stones being the virtuous conduct, the medium grits and the finer grades, the samadhi or the mental unification, steadiness of mind. And then the silent slicer is the wisdom that can cut through anything, the wisdom that can see through the defilements, that can see through things like bias. So there's four biases that the Buddha teaches about, and these things need to be seen through if we want to get to a point of not suffering. And these four biases are called the agatis. The word agati in Pali means bias or leaning. It literally means leaning. It means our leaning. So there's biased by desire. There's biased by anger, biased by fear, biased by delusion. So you have lobhagati, dosagati, mohagati, bhayagati. That's biased by desire, biased by anger, biased by delusion, biased by fear. And we can ask ourselves, you know, how often are our actions of body, speech, and mind pushed around by those inherent biases? And it's good to know this isn't a character judgment, because we all have this. Lay people have this, monks have this. And this is something that is inherent in the human condition. But it doesn't mean we have to be a slave to it. We can actually call it into question. We can be mindful of it. We don't need to be pushed around by our own biases. And much of the time in the Buddha's teaching, when we make decisions, are they really our decisions, or are they decisions of the biases? So if it's a truly unbiased decision, or if it's truly an unbiased viewpoint, it's going to be informed by wisdom. That's panya. It's going to be informed by a mindful recollection of the way things are in the moment. The biases are always putting a spin on things. And then that spin, what does it spin around? It spins around that reference point, which is the sense of self. And that's what we call the atta. And the Buddha taught about not self, anatta. This is one of the more profound or more refined aspects of the Buddha's teaching, which points to some of the realizations that one can experience along the path of practice. And that's that the five khandhas, form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, these are anatta, not self, not to be confused with viratta, which is no self. The Buddha said the view of no self is just another extreme view. So the view of self is one extreme, the view of no self is another extreme. But he said not self is the middle way. The view of self, of an eternal self, is eternalism. The view of no self is nihilism. And not self is the middle way. So it's not necessarily a midpoint between eternalism and nihilism. It's not necessarily moderation, but it's a transcendence of these things, of these five khandhas. And the funeral chanting that we did, it points to that. This is one of the only times we chant the Abhidhamma in our lineage, in our tradition. And so just lists of these things, the six sense bases, the five khandhas, the indriyas, the faculties, and just lists of these terms. And just as a reminder, the paticca-samuppada, the dependent origination, the Four Noble Truths, what we chanted earlier is just list these lists. But the not self is, there's a swirling vortex around this sense of self, this mysterious sense of self. And then the realization of not self is when the mind with wisdom clearly sees that in the middle of that vortex, it's empty. There's not actually a reference point. So, but the reference point is defined by those four biases. So our whatever reference point we're referring to, those biases are always leading us back to it. And so we can actually use our own biases to develop mindfulness, to develop wisdom. We can actually see, where are we constantly coming from? What are we always referring back to? And then if we're able to see through that swirling dark vortex, which is swirling around, it's like the biases are like this vortex, which are swirling around this reference point, which is the sense of self. But then that's empty. There's actually just emptiness there. It's not substantial. And so this is when we start to see not self. And it's similar to the Buddha's teaching where he says, well, monks, when I show you this pile of grass and this pile of sticks and this pile of leaves and this pile of rubble, if I was to say, if it's not yours, do you pick it up? And they say, well, no. And is this pile of grass yours? Well, no. Will you pick it up? No, because it's not mine. Is this pile of rubble yours? Is this pile of sticks yours? No, we don't pick it up because it's not ours. It doesn't belong to us. So just so this body is not yours, it doesn't belong to you, don't pick it up. These feelings are not yours. They don't belong to you. Don't pick them up. These perceptions are not yours. They don't belong to you. Don't pick them up. These mental formations are just conditions, causes and conditions flowing along in nature. They're not me, not mine. Don't pick them up. Consciousness is not yours. Don't pick it up. These are phenomena in nature which are no different than piles of grass, piles of twigs, piles of leaves, and so on. That's a very, very refined teaching and difficult to understand, difficult to make sense of. It's also implicit in the Four Noble Truths when the Buddha says there is suffering. It's the first noble truth. He doesn't say there is your suffering or my suffering, or this person's suffering, or that person's suffering. It just says there is suffering. So there is suffering as a natural phenomenon. And it's not personal. It's not self. It's not owned by anybody. But then it's the picking of things up, which is the very cause of the suffering. So we don't really need to understand these things quickly. It's just coming back to doing our daily practice and the mindfulness and so on. But it's good to think about these things and reflect on these things. And it can be quite fun to reflect on these things. And it all comes back to what makes a person not afraid to die. Well, if the body is already seen as not self, you know, what are we losing? We're not really losing anything. If we haven't picked anything up, what is there to lose? So if there's nothing to lose at the time of death, of course there's not going to be suffering at that time. Of course we're not going to be afraid to die. It's not going to be seen as a tragedy. It's not that change is difficult. This kind of change is going to be difficult, say for people who are left behind, people who we still have more lifetime left in us. How much? We don't know, but we still have more lifetime left in us, those of us who are still alive. And if we are afraid to die, death is just change. So that means we're afraid of change. If we're afraid of change, then we could extend that to say we're afraid to die. If we're not afraid to die, then we're not afraid of change. If we're not afraid of change, we could extend that to say we're not afraid to die. So you know, these reflections can be quite pertinent. The death contemplation, we can come at it from so many different angles, and it can have the heart can become lighter. We can become more lighthearted and take things a bit less seriously, and things are a bit less problematic when we learn how to think in this way. It's not the result we're looking for is a lightening of the heart. It's not, we don't want to become heavy-hearted and melancholy. And if that happens, then we need to set that reflection aside and focus more on trying to cultivate goodwill for ourselves and others. So if the death contemplation gets too heavy, usually it's best to go into metta, kamatana, the sense of developing goodwill for oneself and for others. And then we can come back to the death contemplation when we feel that the heart has been buoyed up again. And that's how we practice. We're allowed to think of these things when we're meditating. It doesn't just have to be focusing on the breath. We are allowed to reflect on these things, contemplate these things, not just while we're meditating, but throughout the day. We think it over and see if we're able to really keep it in mind, really hold it in mind, and then notice it all around us. Notice that it is the way it is. It is the truth of the way things are. These natural phenomenon that just happen. So these are a few reflections coming up for me this evening, and I truly wish Yom Nit well, wherever she may be. And I say sadhu for her practice, and I'll leave it there for this evening.